And so this morning, we are going to be completing a sermon series that we started just a couple of weeks ago, a three-week series on the prophet Jonah, Jonah and the whale. Most of us, I know maybe not all of us, but most of us grew up with this story. We know the story of Jonah and the whale. And so we've tried to dig in at least the last couple of weeks. We tried to go down to some deeper points into this book of Jonah. And I hope it's helped you, because there's some surprising things to be found and learned from Jonah. It's more than a whale tale. There are some profound things. And particularly, I find it on this particular Sunday, which is Christ the King, just before we get into this whole Christmas rush, that to kind of look at anger mismanagement, because Jonah definitely had some anger mismanagement, might be a timely thing for us all to remember to be more patient and loving and forgiving and gracious as we go into this holiday time. And so, but just to kind of review the story, you know the story. You know, Jonah is called to go to Nineveh. He hated the people of Nineveh. The Jews hated the people in Nineveh. They were enemies, and with good reason. The Ninevites were terrorists. They were just think the worst terrorism that you know, or have seen or witnessed, and multiply it. That's how Nineveh was. They truly were awful, terrible people. I don't want to paint them as this sort of kind of pathetic little group of people that, you know, no, they were awful people. Jonah had a really good reason to not want to go to them. They were awful. He hated them. They were natural enemies. But God loved them, and he wanted Jonah to go. In fact, he wanted Jonah to go so bad that when Jonah headed off toward Tarshish in the opposite direction, he sends a bad storm, and he ends up being thrown over sea. You know the story. Well, our big fish swallow him, throws him up on the beach, and we start the whole cycle again. This time he goes to Nineveh, and he preaches, tells them that it's going to be destroyed in 40 days. They don't get their act right, and they do. They do. We pick it up. And so we're kind of got a little bit of an overlap from last week, if you were here. But just this picture of where he has preached to them, and they have heard the message, and they have gone into this time of fasting and praying with sackcloth and ashes and asking God for repentance. And it says, when God saw what they did and how they turned from their evil ways, he relented and did not bring on them the destruction he had threatened. It's why he sent Jonah there, because you know, he's hoping they would do that. But to Jonah, this seemed wrong. Because the Ninevites were, they were awful people. And he became angry at this. He said, Lord, isn't this what I said when I was at home? You know, I knew you were going to do this. This is what I tried to forestall by fleeing to Tarshish. I knew that you are gracious and compassionate, slow to anger and abounding in love, who relents from sending calamity. Now, Lord, take away my life, for it is better for me to die than live. He's really upset about this. Do you get that? Really upset. I'd rather die than live. It's like, I hate the God of love. It's kind of the rail that he has here. But the Lord replied, is it right for you to be angry? And so then Jonah had gone out, and he sat down at a place east of the city. Goes there, he makes himself a little shelter, he sat in its shade, and he waited to see what happened to the city. Because, you know, I don't know, he's just so upset about all of this, and maybe he's hoping that God will change his mind and just decide to destroy them after all. I don't know what his reason, but he's seething out there. He's angry, and he goes out and he builds this little lean-to, and he sets up to watch the city and see what happens. And God provided a leafy plant and made it grow up over Jonah to give shade for his head to ease his discomfort. And Jonah was very happy about the plant. And for the first time in the book of Jonah, we hear the words that Jonah was happy. The only time in the book of Jonah where he's happy is when this plant grows up and his needs are met and he gets to sit in the shade for a while. And he's happy. He likes the plant. But at dawn the next day, God provided a worm which chewed the plant so that it withered. And then the sun rose. God provided a scorching east wind and the sun blazed on Jonah's head so that he grew faint. And he wanted to die. He said, it would be better for me to die than to live. You know, just think about going back home. Maybe that's why he didn't want to go back home. He has caused the Ninevites, by his preaching, to not be destroyed. And all the Jews hate. I mean, it's, you know, he is upset about this. He is pitching a hissy fit. I'll give him that. But he is upset, and really, in some ways, we might say he's got justified by for being upset, except for the fact that God is in this, and this is the way God is, and this is the way God calls us to be. But still, he is there. He is so upset, he wished he would die. Just think about, you know, I remember when my children were little. I'm sure your children didn't do this, but, you know, when they wouldn't get their way sometimes, they would, like, throw a tantrum. Anybody ever? Yeah, a few of y'all. I think they might even say, well, I just wish I were dead. Think I'll just go eat worms. I get so upset. But God said to Jonah, is it right for you to be angry about the plant? I love this. It is, he said. And I'm so angry, I wish I were dead. So he ain't backing off. God's trying to reason with him. You know, is it, you know, it's just a plant. Is it right for you to be? It is. And I wish I were dead. So then God makes this point. You have been concerned about this plant. You did not tend it or make it grow. It sprang up overnight, died overnight. And should I have not concern for the great city of Nineveh? Which, can you imagine how those words would stick in Jonah's to say, great city of Nineveh? Think about the city that you hate the most. Great city of Nineveh, in which there are more than 120,000 people who cannot tell their right hand from their left, and also many animals. And then turn the page to the next. Wait, that's it. That's the end. You seem stunned. That's the end of the book of Jonah. It ends with that. Now, how many of you, a few weeks ago when we started, kind of knew the story of Jonah? You'd say, yeah, I know the story of Jonah. It's about Jonah and the whale, and, you know, he's supposed to go there and that. But how many of you knew that the book ended with the phrase, and also many animals? It kind of just hangs there, doesn't it? He ends with this question. This question that shows God's compassion and mercy. And so since it ends with a question, let's start with the question. And the question is this: what was Jonah really mad about? Was he mad that this worm had come and eaten the plant? Well, I mean, aggravated by that, but that really wasn't what was driving his anger, right? It's important for us, and one thing I think we can learn from the story, it's important for us to be self-aware when it comes to our emotions, and particularly our anger, and to realize that oftentimes anger is a secondary emotion. A number of years ago, my sister Louise passed away of cancer. She battled it for a number of years, and we were hopeful, and then things got bad really fast, and she died, and it was, you know, we were very close. She was a wonderful person, and it just, we were all devastated. And so the day of the funeral came, and what was going on parallel in our lives at that time is my daughter was in driving school, Taggart's driving school, and, you know, so she had to go to so many lessons, and the day of the funeral, she was scheduled for a lesson, and so we had called and said, hey, she's not going to be able to make that lesson, and she's getting ready for the driving test, can she make it up? And they said, no, she can't make it up here at this location, but there's another location close by, and she can go make it up there. So that seemed reasonable. We made the schedule for a couple of days after the funeral. So a couple of days after the funeral, I drive Anna over to the driving school. And you got to understand that it's just like a little storefront somewhere. You just open up the door, and there's like chairs all around. They may have like a screen, and there's like maybe a little welcome desk. And that's the whole shooting match. So all of the class is already in there when we get there. And so I go in and begin to explain to the person who was going to be teaching the class, who was receiving the classes in, that that we had had the death in the family, and the other school had sent us over there to make up this lesson. And the man immediately said, we can't take her, I'm full, I can't do that. And then he kind of got really, you know, sort of hissy with me because that, you know, he was going to have to take this other person. And so what happened next was I completely, completely lost it. Now, some of you I know better than others, and maybe some of you think you've seen me live before. You have not seen me lose it the way that I lost it in these moments. I just went off on this person. And so they just said they would take Anna. And then Anna had to walk past the desk to the rest of the people that were sitting behind there that had heard this whole thing and be there for the rest of the day. And immediately realized what I had done. And I had a moment of self-awareness. Was I upset that this guy was being a jerk? No, I was upset because this is the kinds of things that grief can do to us and stress can do to us. Sometimes we get angry just because we're tired. You get impatient sometimes when you're tired. Somebody cuts you off in traffic and you like, you know, why are you surprised that someone cuts you off in traffic? You've driven on I-20 and I-285 before, right? That's what people do. Why are we so upset? Because it's not really that. Right? It's something else. Anger is a secondary emotion. We need to recognize that. Oftentimes we're angry, and you know, with little kids, it's easier to see than maybe with adults. But if we really start breaking it down, it's because of something we're afraid about. There's a fear there. Maybe sometimes a fear of losing something or not getting something that we feel we deserve, and so that makes us angry. There's this importance of this self-awareness, and I want to pull that over into this example here. To explain and set this up, you got to know that we went to Asheville this week to visit my son and his girlfriend. I had a great time there for a few days, but we stayed in a hotel, and we'd go to their house to eat, and that's about all we did. And so I'm there. We're there the first day, and we got a few hours. We're going to his restaurant, so we made reservations. And so I'm working on my sermon. So you may wonder how sometimes things end up in my sermons the way they do. And it's just at the particular time when I got to this particular point, the TV is on, and it's let me skip that. The TV is on, and it's the People's Court, which I was unaware was still a thing. I mean, I know about Judge Judy and some of the other ones, but I didn't know the People's Court was still on. And so I took notice. And it's not Judge Wapner anymore. I grew up with Judge Wapner. It's Judge, what's her name, John? Judge Miliana now. And man, she is sassy. She's a little bit more like Judge Judy, but I like her. She's good. And so I start watching this thing, and it's still exactly the same, down to, if you haven't watched it in years, but back in the day, there's Judge Wapner, and there's Doug Llewellyn. Remember Doug Llewellyn? I call him the courtroom weenie. He's the guy who sits there with the microphone, and he says, like, well, you just got embarrassed on national TV. How do you feel? But it always starts out, they show you the back of the courtroom, right, and the door's opening, and somebody's coming up, and it goes, dun-dun, dun-dun. Is it? The plaintiff has accused the defendant of poisoning his entire family when they went to eat at his pizzeria. All seven of them got desperately sick, and he is suing for $1,500. And so my mind immediately goes, wow, this is cut, and I mean, this is over. I mean, all seven of them, that doesn't seem like a coincidence. All seven of them, okay, so I know this, what the outcome of this is going to be. And then the defendant comes in, and here's the story. It's his brother. And he has sued him like 20 times before. He's always suing him. And his family has never even been to this guy's restaurant. There's no proof of it. But he's always suing his brother. And so then you hear the other side. But you know how quickly we are sometime when we just hear one side to go immediately say, that's the thing. And in this time and age where we are sort of conditioned to outrage, you know, and somebody will give us like one part of a story that will just kind of go with the worldview that they have. It's like, oh, and suddenly we just jump to this, you know, this conclusion about it. And, you know, yeah. But we don't stop to hear the other way. Proverbs 18:17 says this, the first to testify always seems right. The first to testify always seems right. And you know how that works. You just hear one side of the slanted way, where it's always told with a narrative where that person is the victim, right? And we do that even within our own minds. And I got to thinking about that in a personal way. If I'm going to have self-awareness, why am I going to trust my own initial thoughts about something, my own initial prejudice? And because I tell you why. You know, we can't help it. We're human beings, I know. But if we don't ever get past this, we are never going to rescue the perishing. We are never going to preach the Ninevites if it's just going to be our worldview. And so they are already guilty before they even walk into the courtroom. Because we've never failed. We have failed to listen. We have failed to show them the compassion and love of God. So I read this book, Unoffendable. And it's a great little book. It's not real long. The guy's Brant Hanson. He's got a lot of great quotes within it. He said, yes, the world is broken, but don't be offended by it. Instead, thank God that He's intervened in it. And He's going to restore it to everything it was meant to be. His kingdom is breaking through bit by bit. Recognize it and wonder at it. And so his point is that, yes, there is righteous anger, for sure. But we can't stay with that. In fact, his point is, God can have, God can have righteous anger. I'm not sure we can. But yes, we are going to get upset by things in the world, but there's so much about what we get upset. Why does it surprise us? Why do we get angry because Uncle Ralph said something racist at the Thanksgiving dinner table? Because Uncle Ralph always says that. We should expect it. Why do we get upset somebody cut us off? So if we live our lives in such a way that we're out there and we're ready to be offended everywhere we go, then we are going to be offended. We need to live our lives with much more understanding and gracious living. He says this, one of his quotes says, few want to hear this, but it's true, and it can be enormously helpful in life. If you're constantly being hurt, offended, or angered, you should honestly evaluate your inflamed ego. You know, Jonah's sitting there so angry about a plant. He gets upset and angry, wants to die over a plant. Because Jonah had put himself at the exact center of that story. And even though he was justified, or we could say that he was justified, and understand because of how awful, awful the Ninevites were, God had different plans. And if we are going to hear from God to be able to bring those other plans to this world that so desperately needs to hear it, then we've got to be willing to listen, to respond, to forgive, to step out. Anger feels very powerful sometimes. Anger, I think sometimes we might say, does it help us to get angry? Right? I'm going to ask you that question. Does it help us to get anger? Does it help me to get anger? Some people would propose that they need to get angry because it helps them to fight injustice. I need to get angry because it helps me fight injustice. And I would propose to you that it doesn't. That it doesn't. Anger doesn't help your judgment. And you know this, right? Anger doesn't help you make better decisions. There is this fight or flight response. It gets us out of danger. But we immediately need to move on. There's a verse in Colossians that says, it talks about righteous anger. But the very next verse is, don't let the sun go down on your anger. We can't hang on to that anger. You know, yeah, it might get us there, and it might lift us into action, but we can't live there. When you think about it, people, if someone has a story that they can share with me where this has been the case, I would love to hear it. But I cannot tell you one person who's been led to Christ because somebody was angry with them. I can't remember where somebody's been angry and this person's, you know, upset and they're authoritative on this and they're you know, that kind of, the people are changed by love. Their hearts are changed by love so that when they get to a point where they may feel like they need Christ, they're going to seek out the person that has shown them acceptance and love and compassion and mercy and sat there and cried with them and listened to them, not the person who has been angry at them and has passed judgment on them. If we want to bring hope and healing, then we need to learn to love as God has loved. Colossians 3:8 says this, after it's talked about righteous anger and act free, it's talked about not letting the sun go down on our anger. It says, but now you must also rid yourself of all such things as these: anger, rage, malice, slander, and filthy language from your lips. You know, it can't have a place with us. C.S. Lewis has a book called The Great Divorce. And it talks about the end of all things and there's a heaven and there's a hell. And there is this bus, if you're not familiar with the story, there's this bus that goes every day from hell to heaven. And people are invited and willing to get on that bus to go to heaven. You would think everybody would, right? And so in this story, this guy gets on the bus and he gets there and he gets to heaven. And one of the first people he meet was somebody that he knew from life before he had died. And the guy had been a murderer. And the guy had been a thief. And he says, "How did you get here? You're a murderer and you're a thief. You don't belong here." And he says, "I don't belong here. I did horrible things. I hurt people. But it's only by the grace of God that I am here and can rejoice in that." And this man gets very angry and he gets back on the bus that goes to hell. Because he would rather live separated from God than to live in a heaven where God would let this person in. Are there people that would fit on that line for you? I've got some people that I would struggle with. And Jonah certainly had people that he struggled with the Ninevites. And so we get to the end of the sermon series, the end of the book. And I want to mention one other book that is very helpful throughout this whole series. It's Timothy Keller's book called The Prodigal Prophet. And in that, he does a lot of parallel with how the story of Jonah is really kind of a foreshadowing of some of the stuff that you see in the New Testament, including Jesus, Jonah going into the belly of the whale for 3 days, and Jesus going into the tomb for 3 days. And he talks about Jonah and the Ninevites and Jesus' parable of the prodigal son. You know, and the prodigal son goes and does horrible things. He basically says to his dad when he asks for his inheritance, "I wish you were dead," because that's what the same was. And y'all have heard sermons on that before, I don't have to tell you. He goes into foreign land, he does awful, terrible things, but he repented and he came back. And there was another son, the good son, who had kept the law, who had done all of the things. And they're throwing a big party, and this son separates himself from the herd and goes off, you know, and stands and is pitching a fit. And his father comes out and he says, "Don't you know that we had to rejoice because your son that was lost has been found?" And it's sort of like what we see at the end of the book of Jonah. You know, 120,000 souls and also so many animals. I love it that the animals get mentioned. And so there's this sort of crisis moment where the story ends in the book of Jonah. So what's the rest of the story? What happens next? What happened to Jonah? How does the story end? We're left hanging. You know, if they were writing this for Hollywood, you know, this would be the cliffhanger of the end of the season, because we don't know. And the truth is, we don't know. We don't know, and we don't know the end of a lot of our stories yet, because they haven't been written yet. And so I like it in a way that it ends the way that it does. But Tim Keller makes this proposition, or theory, that I like a lot, and I agree with it, that Jonah ended in a good place. One is, I told you last week, that place was Jonah's tomb was revered by Christians and Jews and Muslims. He was a great symbol in that. Okay, so if he ended with a temper tantrum there outside of Nineveh, that's not a very good place. So there may be more to his story than we know. And here's what he says. He says, "The book of Jonah ends as a bit of a cliffhanger. We are never told how the prophet responded to God's final appeal. I propose, however, that we can make a reasonable guess about how Jonah ultimately responded to God. How do we know that Jonah was so recalcitrant and defiant and clueless? How do we know that he made that unbelievable, 'I hate the God of love' speech? How do we know these things? How do we know about his prayer inside the fish? The only way that we could possibly know these things is if Jonah told others." That Jonah told his story. "And what kind of man would let the world see what a fool he was? Only someone who had become joyfully secure in God's love. Only someone who believed that he was simultaneously sinful but completely accepted. In short, someone who has found in the gospel of grace the very power of God. And if it can change Jonah, it can change anyone. It can change me, and it can change you. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen." I just love the words there, that last verse. "The finest bread I will provide." Knowing that works on a couple of levels, we think about in Holy Communion, but knowing that Jesus Himself was the bread of life, God's Son that was given for us and for the world, for these people that He loved. That out, whether it's outside on the hillside looking into Nineveh to those people there, or as Jesus sat praying over Jerusalem, that our hearts could be there with them, that our hearts would break with the things that break God's, and that we would have the same compassion and mercy and love for this world, for all people of this world, that God has, because we have received that love ourselves. This Advent, this Christmas. May that love be born anew in our hearts as we prepare to do the gospel together. Go in God's peace.